this afternoon session. We have a Swedish head of the committee, and they have a Swedish discipline. We start 2 minutes early every session. So I'm very happy to introduce our next speaker. I have to say I'm also happy to see a female speaker at the meeting. I'm looking very much forward to hearing your talk. Clarissa Jones, Professor of Psychology at the University of Texas. Welcome.
Thank you, and I'm delighted to be in Oslo. It's also my first time in Oslo. This was the title of my talk, but I'm amending it right now to take out the stimulating part. This is because when I was invited, I did not realize that I would be following Dr. Klein and Dr. Nudo, and I knew very well that Dr. Nudo knows a lot more than me about this. And so luckily, that prediction was correct. This might be my 10th or 12th time to give talks after Dr. Klein and Dr. Nudo. And it's really a bad thing to do. I am not going to be as dynamic of a speaker, but I'll do my best. I'm a lab rat in a sense myself, just a nerd. Okay? You've heard a lot about this morning, so I'm not going to dwell on it, but on the other hand, remind you, because this is actually the focus of my talk and of my work, that experience drives neuroplasticity in the brain, and it does that throughout life, because it is really just a basic mechanism for encoding experiences and changing behaviors. In a sense, it's nothing that special. Okay? This is important to appreciate, well, not the not special thing, because obviously I think it's pretty cool, or I wouldn't study it myself. But on the other hand, it is an everyday kind of process. Otherwise, we would not be able to learn and change our behavior. However, injury itself also induces many regenerative responses. There are intrinsic mechanisms that get instigated when the brain is injured. And this injury-induced neuroplasticity, many aspects of it are neural activity dependent and can be influenced by behavioral change. Let me not delve in yet. So my central focus is on how these injury-induced neuroplasticity can be influenced by behavioral changes, and also how they may normally be influenced by behavioral changes. And you'll see what I mean in a minute. Stroke, for example, this is an example at you may not be able to see this very well, but these are cortical infarcts from a rat, and the green are cells that are dying, largely staining. This death of cells results in not just death of cells in the cortex, of course, but it results in degeneration of their projections to wherever they're projecting to. In the case of cortically focused infarct, these projections are to a lot of places, underlying striatum, corticospinal tract, contralateral cortex. So even a focal injury in a brain produces degenerative responses in a very widespread part of the brain. Every place that was connected to this region can be expected to react to the presence, to the onset of degenerative signals. Now, that onset of degenerative signals instigates calloreactions. Brains must have long ago evolved to deal with bits of damage, or you would not see such an orchestrated response. In response to the onset of axonal degeneration, axonal sprouting is triggered. In mature brains, the sprouting doesn't typically go long distances. But instead, you have axons that project to the denervated region that are already there, sprout new processes and form synapses with neurons that have just lost some of their connections due to a remote brain area. It's not long distance, but you can really rewire circuits with this so-called collateral sprouting. This axonal sprouting is at least sometimes coordinated with dendritic growth and dendritic remodeling, and of course with the formation of new synapses. These neural events are coordinated with vascular remodeling, sometimes with remyelination, and with various cell proliferative events. And this is a short list. My point here is that brain damage is a whole brain event of remodeling. Now, how it remodels, of course, is going to vary depending on how hard it gets hit with degeneration. And the tissue that's right next to an injury copes with different things, right, than a tissue that's just losing a few axons. Okay? But still, this occurs. Now, I'm making a point of this because you don't need to read this little table. This is really the main point. Making a point of this because you can find in the animal literature doing a lousy PubMed search hundreds and hundreds of articles showing that various aspects of both the degenerative process and the regenerative counter-reaction that is instigated can be manipulated by behavioral experiences, by behavioral manipulations in animal models. And very often, it can be manipulated in both directions. You can find manipulations that promote increases in growth factors, those that decrease them, that promote glial responses, and decrease them, and same for axonal sprouting, dendritic growth, etc. Now, I'm focusing on structural things here, but many molecules related to this regenerative and degenerative response are influenced. So why do we care about that? From my perspective, as someone who wants to understand how the brain reorganizes in response to stroke, this requires me to understand how it's influenced by the behavioral changes that result from stroke. Stroke results in behavioral changes as a result of creating impairments. A reliable response to the onset of a disability is that people and other animals come up with compensatory behavioral strategies for dealing with them. Compensations found across modalities of impairments, but after stroke, a particularly prevalent form of compensation because of the prevalence of hemiparesis is to start relying more on the non-paretic hand and arm. It's lateral to the stroke. This is a major kind of behavioral change. We go through life using both our hands together most of the time. Catherine Lane's activity monitor data taught me this. People move their hands together. After stroke, people learn to use the less affected non-paretic hand and arm in different ways than they did before the stroke as a result of impairments in one. So I'm not talking about rehabilitative training now, right? But hey, this is a behavior that probably starts early after stroke, right? And it is definitely well practiced. It may not be as well practiced as one would do if they were using both their hands together, but it involves new skill learning, which in intact brains is very effective at promoting neuronal, structural, and functional changes. Now, I think you've been primed for this. In fact, I have some of the same slides as earlier speakers. In intact animals, learning things like skilled reaching tasks, promotes increases in synapses and dendrites in motor cortex, for example. Reorganizes maps, as you know, and Jeff talked about these data earlier today, and Newman's effects of practice on a motor task, rapidly changing motor cortex. So there are clearly behavioral changes that are instigated by stroke that should have the potential to influence neural remodeling events that are instigated by stroke. And so do they, and what does that mean for function? So in the context of how the brain reorganizes after stroke, I think we need to ask this question, because I think it is likely that with the regenerative counter-reactions to stroke, that behavioral changes after stroke are probably shaping neural reorganization. I'll show you a little of our data that suggested it. But this neural reorganization is not necessarily the best outcome you can get. And so we need to understand that what we want to do is to drive the reorganization in directions that optimize functional outcome. I hope I'm making sense. Okay, so that's the big picture. My lab has been studying this in rodents exclusively, using various types of infarcts, but I'm going to focus on the effects of motor cortical lesions. Rats, like humans, after damage to the unilateral damage to the motor system, they stop using the non-paretic, less affected limb as much, and they rely more on the paretic limb. Now, it may not matter, I don't know, but I sometimes refer to the non-paretic limb as the good limb and the paretic limb as the bad limb. And it doesn't reflect value judgments about the limbs. It's just that the terminology we have for the two limbs is varied across the animal and clinical literature. And I also use the wrong words for them all the time. Whereas I can keep good and bad straight. So, okay. All right. So I tend to run out of time in talks. And so I've learned to give my main points first. One is that neural remodeling after brain damage is experience dependent, with or without interventions. We probably need to consider that. The other is that experiences can promote neural reorganization patterns that are sometimes not good for functional outcome. More plasticity doesn't mean better function. We actually need to figure out what kind of plasticity is the right kind, and then how to drive it. Okay, so you've seen a lot of these pictures already, but just to prime you, rats with motor impairments early after the infarcts. But you can see these sorts of impairments and changes in how they and their behavior in other tasks too. This is the vermicelli handling task in rats. Vermicelli is a type of pasta, and I don't know why, but rats really love pasta. They're not used to eating it though, and so they develop these really dexterous, coordinated ways of moving it into their mouth. And you can see after cortical infarcts that they continue to use their bad limb, but they don't use it in a dexterous way that they did before. This was early after the infarcts, and it's particularly impaired rat. Over time, if you give them a lot of practice in vermicelli eating, this highly motivated task, you'll see that they start using it more on the pasta, but they never recover the dexterous digit movements. We call them digits instead of fingers. They never recover their finger movements from moving it into the mouth. So you can also just look at the rats. Oh, the movies did work, and I was subverting it. Okay. The rats also you can see them not use it for things like supporting themselves against walls, right? Now, in the home cage, Dr. Klein made this point. The home cage of a laboratory rat is really boring. If you don't give them pasta pieces, there's not a lot of things for them to do with their forelimbs that are very skilled. Right? They start disusing their bad limb, but they're probably not having major demands on what they have to learn with their good limb. Versus a human having to get up and learning how to dress with dominant reliance on their non-phoretic hand and to feed themselves and on and on and on. The rats really don't have this demand. So, in some ways, that makes the rat not a particularly great model of the human condition, right? On the other hand, it lets people like me control that behavior after it. And so that's what we're doing. And I also, you guys may not even know, some of you won't even know the difference, but these are mice. And later, I'm going to start with rats, but we also have some work in mice. And for the mice, because they have not been, they've been more popular among molecular biologists than behavioral neuroscientists like me. The behaviors aren't as refined for them, but we've got them good enough for some of our questions. And if I don't run out of time, I'll show you that again. Okay, so I just told you that I was calling this the bad limb, contralateral to the stroke, and this is the good limb. The bad limb is disused spontaneously. The good limb is increased in use, even though the good limb also has moderate impairments, so detectable impairments, it's the better functioning limb. And they and people at least learn new ways of using it. So what effect does this have on brain? Well, one place, one place that you might think that learning and using the good limb might influence is the contralateral motor cortex. Because this region is the region that adds new synapses, grows dendrites, etc., when animals, including humans, learn new things, right? And so for years we investigated contralateral cortex, but it was sort of long ago, so I'm going to summarize it in one slide if you don't mind. What we found is that this process of learning to use the good forelimb after strokes interacts with degenerative, the reactions to cortical injuries to result in growth of dendrites, and as well as spines, and they actually overshoot a bit and partially eliminate. But it's very spectacular dendritic growth response that you don't get if you bind up that limb, and you also don't get if you take an intact animal and you force them to use only one limb. Right? It seems to be a response to the combination of the injury and the behavioral experience. But this effect in contralateral motor cortex is related to the behavior, but we can find no evidence that it is a growth response that's good for the bad limb. Right? And in fact, we found that at least some types of learning with this good limb can be deleterious for the bad limb. This interaction of experience with regenerative reactions to the stroke is good for the good limb, but it, in some ways at least is bad for the bad limb. And the way we first, Rachel Allred, a former graduate student, first found this in my lab, the way that we detected this is we did this study that confuses everybody. We've done the study several times now, but my way of explaining it confuses people, so hopefully I'll do it right now. Okay. So what we did to to try to model the effects of learning new ways of using the good lab after strokes, we took animals and we gave them infarcts and motor cortex, and then we trained them on the good lab in the skill reaching task. Other animals, control animals, go into the box and they get the pellets, but they don't have to learn skills for them. And then we asked how this influences the bad limb. Okay? And so this graph is of the bad limb. And what we found is that the ability to make the bad limb better with training was greatly diminished in animals that before this had training focused on the good limb. This effect occurs whether the animals knew the task with the 2B bad limb before the strokes or didn't know the task. And it is associated with an exaggeration of disuse of the bad limb for movements just around the home cage. But it is not found if you give them training at the same time of the good limb. So it seems to be specifically an effect of learning new unimanual skills with the good limb. It is also dependent upon the colossal connections between intact and peri-infarct motor cortex, which we discovered just by cutting corpus callosum at the time of the infarcts. If you do that, then learning a new skill with your good limb does not significantly worsen performance and training and induce functional improvements compared to animals that did not learn the skill with the good limb. Okay. This effect is also associated with changes in neural activation of motor cortex during training. Well, let me just start calling it rehabilitative training. Rehabilitative training means training the bad limb. Everyone go with that? Okay, alright. So training the bad limb. That the activation of neurons that can be detected by this immediate early gene that gets accumulated with neural activity, that the activation of neurons in peri-infarct cortex with rehabilitative training is diminished as a result of having learned the task with the good limb first. So these data have been replicated by, the behavioral effects have been replicated by others. Del Corbett's group recently reported that the effects of learning a new task with the good limb persist for at least 2 months after training with the good limb ends. These findings on neural activation were the first to make us aware that we should be looking in peri-infarct cortex for the mechanisms of the deleterious influences of compensatory skill learning with the good limb. And so we moved our focus from contralateral cortex to peri-infarct cortex. And when we go here, I need to remind you of what the speakers this morning told you. Hopefully your memories are good enough that'll be easy. That training the paretic forelimb is very well established at this point to reorganize movement representations in motor cortex. Even though the reorganization follows the behavioral improvements, it's also established that the reorganization it reflects those improvements, because if you block reorganization, pharmacological manipulations are disrupted. You can block the benefits of rehabilitative training in animal models. The functional benefits. This was a slide that Jeff Klein gave me, I don't know, 10 years ago, and you've improved it. But the map reorganization, the fact that maps presumably reflect that there's substantial changes and connectivity. In my lab, I'm not going to show you the data for this, but my lab has found, for example, that rehabilitative training promotes synapse addition in regions where you get reemergence for the movement representations. So I think that the map changes reflect substantial underlying changes. And so it seemed reasonable, this scientific, it seemed reasonable for us to ask, does learning new skills with your good limb influence the reorganization that occurs with rehabilitative training? So we used ICMS approaches. This is an example from one rat. But I just wanted to briefly tell you that these are going to look a little different from the other maps you've seen. In our studies, what these data are averages of the percent area of any forelimb representation in green and any head representation in yellow. Okay. Rats have large forelimb representation and large head representations. It's so primate-like. If you map motor cortex, it's just filled with head and forelimb. The forelimb is central and the head surrounds it. Okay. Now, after unilateral ischemic infarcts, and the lesions are, so this is an average lesion, so we're taking the same approach with lesions. So this is the caudal forelimb area of primary motor cortex, the rostral area, and premotor cortex-ish. If you do no manipulations to the rats over time, what you find is a loss of what's left of forelimb representation. It's not always as complete of a loss. This is sort of an extreme example, but they're definitely reduced. But it's not just that the cortex becomes silent, that you start finding head representations in places where there's which are still anatomical forelimb motor cortical regions. Okay. With rehabilitative training, in this study, we started it at 3 weeks, with a brief 18-day period of rehabilitative training, we found that you promote the maintenance of forelimb representations, and maybe a little expansion too, but mostly it was the maintenance of the forelimb representation, not this progressive loss. So the question is, so these are rats again, these are rats just getting rehabilitative training, and they live in boring cages. So, but what happens if they have to learn new skills with their good limb? So, that's the question. If they have to learn new skills with their good limb, does it influence the maps before the onset of rehabilitative training? Does it influence the effects of rehabilitative training on the maps? Okay. This is no, this is yes. And I'll just show you real quick. So we could find no influence of skill training alone on movement representations of the head and forelimb. It doesn't mean that there's no effects there. It just means we didn't affect the maps. However, if we looked after the period of rehabilitative training, we found greatly diminished forelimb movement representations in animals that had learned the skill before the onset of rehabilitative training, and the animals that did not. Now, again, it's not that the area went silent. It's that in the animals that learned the skills with a good limb, they had head representations, especially jaw, tongue, and neck. There's a lot of tongue in rat motor cortex. Anyway. This was not quite as extreme as the animals that had no rehabilitative training at all, but it wasn't much different from that. So something about learning skills with your good limb after unilateral stroke, at least after primary motor cortical infarcts, appears to be disrupting the capacity to drive functional reorganization of the motor cortex to subserve skills with your bad limb. Okay. That's sort of depressing, right? Since most people with Henry Teresa's are going to learn new things with their good mouth. Does this extend to humans? I don't know. Oh, I did want to make this point. You don't need to look at this in any detail if you don't want to, but at least in this study, the effect on learned mouths was in the cortex right around the infarct, which corresponded to primary motor cortex. We found no influence of learning skills with the non-paretic and non-premotor cortex. Not sure where to go with that yet. But anyway, this led us to ask, well, maybe what's going on here is that learning new skills with the good limb is preventing rehabilitative training from driving new synapse formation in that area. Because we had already found that rehabilitative training promotes synapse addition in this region that eventually gets foramen motor maps. And to our surprise, we did not find that. Instead, what we found was that training the good limb followed by rehabilitative training, that external condition had more synapses overall in compared to animals that only had rehabilitative training. So it does not block a synapse addition. Now, the synapse addition was especially profound in this subtype of synapses that I can explain to anybody who is remotely interested later, but unless you're really into synapse structure like I am, you might not be, but just a long story short, they've been implicated in synaptic competition. This effect of adding more synapses was correlated, the quantity of synapses was correlated with whether the animals had more head or foramen representations. So more synapses meant more head. This is the opposite correlation you find if you don't include the experimental condition of learning skills with the good limb. And it's also negatively correlated with behavioral performance at the beginning and at towards the end of the rehabilitation training. Okay, so these data have led us to hypothesize that behavioral experiences can compete in reorganizing brain after stroke, reorganizing what's left of brain after stroke. And we think that the analogy with development, even though it always worries me to relate injured brains to developing brains, because they're actually much different. But on the other hand, a stroke instigates very dramatic regenerative responses in periods of time when there's a real pro-growth kind of environment. And if you can hit that environment with behavioral manipulations that change activity in remodeling circuits, those remodeling circuits are likely to be influenced by that behavior and be driven in directions with it. I think after stroke, it's very likely that remodeling period is overlapping with all the things that you as a stroke survivor, I'm not a stroke survivor, maybe I shouldn't say it that way, all those things that a stroke survivor is learning to do differently. And it's quite possible that learning to do differently is interfering with what we then try later to do with rehabilitative training. The other implication of this is that we're probably not understanding brain reorganization if we don't start thinking about compensatory behavioral experience effects on it. Okay, so my lab is currently, we really should have been done by now, but the good postdoc left, but my lab is currently attesting this hypothesis that experiences of the good limb are driving projections from contralesional cortex to re-innervate regions that have been denervated by the infarct, including the paretic limb's control of corticospinal projection pathways, as well as remaining regions of primary motor cortex, and that this effect competes with the rewiring that could occur from remaining regions of motor cortex of the injured hemisphere, including the rostral forelimb area, the premotor cortex. I don't know the answer to this question yet, but we do have preliminary data. This is a good postdoc, Stephanie Jefferson, that left. She got a really good job, and it's a happy thing. But before she left, she found that that rehabilitative training promotes, rehabilitative training is associated with this increased density of axons and axonal boutons from projecting from rostral motor cortex to peri-infarct motor cortex, which that is very much higher than animals that were trained on the good one. And so it's in the right direction, and we'll see what happens. Now, let me not dwell on it, but my lab, I think actually the field is really aware that not everybody that has hemiparesis has a motor cortical stroke. and so there's been a lot of attempts to move the strokes subcortically. And my lab is, and I feel like this question, really needs to be asked in a subcortical stroke model too, because patterns of rewiring are different after cortical and subcortical strokes, presumably, and the way contralesional motor cortex may influence them could be too. And so I don't know if the behavioral effects of learning skills with your good limb generalize to these infarcts. We will know very soon. But anyway, we're creating severe and non-severe infarcts in the posterior limb of the internal capsule and investigate the effects of rehabilitative training. So this is what I was hoping to have time for. So I showed you a very simple model system, right? Just one model system, motor cortex rats, they learn. But there's a lot of potential conditions that may apply to the rules of how experiences influence brain reorganization. This is hardly all of them, but to keep the slide simple. We've started to investigate injury locus, agent sex effects, but I wanted to tell you a moment about the timing issue. So, there's a lot of interest, the possibility of capitalizing on these early dynamic periods of neural remodeling. Okay? This issue was raised earlier this morning. There's a potential to make things worse. But maybe there's potential to make things better with your interventions. But the problem is that with all these other conditionalities that might influence how the course of brain remodeling unfolds over time, how in the world are we going to find the right time to hit it, the right time that's safe for everybody and the right time that is effective for everyone? And I'm not suggesting that I'm going to find it, but I do think that the issue, that trying to make time the variable is inherently problematic, given that the variable that we target, time is a problematic target for targeting. Wow, good verbal fluency there. Because of all the things that can influence it, that a neural target or some sort of imaging target that we could find that said, yes, that event's going on, that is very important to hit with rehabilitative training, would be great to have, right? Wouldn't it be? And so we're not going to get there, but I do that ourselves, I think. But I still keep trying and to do it. You know, it's delusional thinking, I guess. But to do it, we are taking advantage of live animal imaging approaches to visualize a blood flow and vasculature and neuronal structural changes over time as they unfold, because we can. To do that, we use mice that have chronic cranial windows, their glass cover slips implanted. The mice don't seem to mind having glass windows in their skull at all. we implant these well before infarcts. And this allows us to image repeatedly specific dendrites, for example, that we find over time. Now, we're not imaging them continuously, but we're taking snapshots over time so that we can relate behavioral changes over the same time span to structural changes. This work was started with Yi Zhao, who's at University of California, Santa Cruz. She was one of the early two photon imagers of dendritic spines, and she's also brilliant. But I just wanted to show you an example of how spines change in intact animals with skill learning. As animals learn a task, now, I did forget to introduce this one. It's not a pellet. They have a matrix of pasta in front of them, and they have to go out and change the reach trajectory for each piece. And we're using this in the mice because if you could say that there was an Einstein in motor skills with four paws, mice are it. We have trouble making the task challenging enough for them. But anyway, as they're learning this motor skill, in the very first few days, and these are mature adult mice, you see that in the dendrites that we image in the foramen region of primary motor cortex had a lot more spines. It's a transient event because this is followed soon after by elimination of a lot of spines. Now, there's not a net gain or loss here, right? They're adding more, then they're losing them. But the new ones that were added first are selectively maintained compared to new spines added in animals that don't keep getting trained. This selective survival of newly generated spines in the first few days of training is correlated with performance improvements that result from the training. Now, this is an intact animal. So what happens when that effect in an intact animal overlaps with the neuronal structural and responses to stroke in peri-infarct cortex, as well as to all the other cellular changes that are going on. And I forgot to mention Wendy Dunn, who's a biomedical engineer who makes really cool imaging approaches for the world. I think I'll skip this. If anybody is interested in a variation of the photothrombotic infarct, I'll tell you about it later. But what we are doing is imaging blood flow recovery, vascular structural changes, which happen in peri-infarct cortex, and dendritic spine changes. So I don't have the convergence yet. That study's ongoing. But I just wanted to show you, relative to the edge of the infarct, a region of severe blood flow reductions, you see this huge increase in the loss of spines. It's quite different from the effects of motor skill training. This is followed by a slight uptick in addition of spines. But mostly what you get close to the infarct in the absence of training is a lot of synapses going away. I should have mentioned spines are the sites of most excitatory synapses in cortex. Not all of them, but most. If you go just a little further away, what you get is increased spine turnover. Right? And so the question is, if you hit this with a behavioral manipulation that is also a very strong signal for influencing the addition and the stability of new spines, what happens? And is that related to time sensitivities in rehabilitation? So I tell you all this, I know you probably just want answers, but I think that this is, it's not going to be an easy question to figure out what time sensitivities depend on, but I do think we have to do it because of the inherent problem of time as a target. Okay. We also, I'm out of time. I also think we need to, everything I just told you was in mature adult animals. And there is a need to look at aging animals in our models. And it just so turns out that the rats that I and Dr. Klein and Dr. Nudo have used are not the best choice for studying aging. Lots of reasons. But the mice are okay. And so we're starting to study aging with them. And we find, let me tell you the best story. We find that in very old mice, these are male mice, with infarcts, we messed up and we made the infarcts too big in the old, we were supposed to match them, but we didn't quite pull it off. But despite that, they still benefit really nicely from motor rehabilitation. In fact, by the end of this two time periods on this postmatrix task, they weren't different. However, this less skilled task, tray reaching task, there's just a tray of pellets, and they go out and sort of scoop them in. The old animals didn't see a functional benefit of that compared to the young animals. So there could be some conditionalities in how we train them. I don't think a single mice study is going to tell you that for the field, though, so please don't stick in your head. But these are more disturbing findings, and this is not stroke. We've started to map middle-aged female rats with a collaborator, and we couldn't find their forelimb maps as easily. And it turns out that in middle-aged female rats, there's a major reduction in the size of the forelimb representation area, but not the overall map. And this is not an effect of estradiol, which we established with various manipulations. This is telling us that we might want to investigate whether there's something important happening at middle age in females that could influence a stroke reorganization. And we just got a small grant to do that. Okay. So I made it to the top. So this is what these are my main points. I think it's clear that we should expect that behavioral experiences after stroke will influence neural remodeling responses, and that they do. Right? There's probably some stroke survivor out there somewhere who has no behavioral change, but I don't think it's the norm. Right? That influences brain remodeling. I think it's probably always happening. Compensatory learning with a good body side has a potent impact on reorganization, for better or worse. There are definitely deleterious consequences after motor cortical infarcts. We don't know yet whether that extends to other ones. I think you got that point, and also that point. But this is another point. I think that I would really like a lot more people in the field working on my questions. Tell people about it. Feel free to scoot me. The last point, I forgot to put it on the slide, is I am very interested in whether compensatory movements that you use to move your paretic arm, such as lines on your trunk and shoulder movements to control hand position, may also have these competitive influences, and we just haven't figured out how to manipulate that in the rats yet, but we will get there. Okay, and these are the ones who do the work while I train.
Thank you very much. We have time for questions. We have about 2 minutes, so any questions?
I don't know if you have the right recipe, but do we know anything about plasticity after a second stroke?
You know, I'm not the right person. So the question was plasticity after a second stroke. Oh, then I'm going to have to add that to my list of things. Yeah, that's true. Thanks, Alex. So Steven Zeiler, Jack Krakauer, I'm not sure this is why you're asking, but they just found that you can, there's time sensitivities and the effects of rehabilitative training in the animal models. They found that if they made a small second stroke close to the first one, they could reopen that time sensitivity. But I'm not sure that's why you were asking.
I think I might answer your question indirectly. There is this precondition model. They induce the small infarct, a stroke. Then they will protect the next stroke. It's just indirectly. Then I have one question for you. You mentioned this plasticity. Not all is good. I agree with you. But do you have some idea to give us how to produce more good plasticity and avoid the bad one?
I have lots of ideas, but I work with rats, right? Seriously, our models are not humans, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's clear that that it's helpful to use the rules of learning, right, the things that drive the plasticity, the things that Jeff talked about this morning, repetition, salience, and such like that. I know that those are very general ideas, but it's what we've got right now. I do feel like we can do a lot better. I mean, I'm not blaming us. I mean, we're working really hard. I mean, in the field as a whole.
One question. You talked about this, that this new skill learning maybe not so good for the learning navigation for that.
Yeah.
But how about just not new skills, just activation? We use this good more often, not learning.
We have not found that it's deleterious just to use it more. It seems to be specifically bad for the bad limb to learn new ways of using the non-paretic limb. We've got lots of data on this to simplify. You can completely avoid that effect if you give them enough skillful things, including bimanual things, to do with the paretic limb at the same time. So I think, encourage. So that's not a problem. It's getting around through life with dominant or sole reliance on the credit card. Yeah.
Okay.
Did you say social factors? Psychosocial factors. I think that I would just be expressing my opinion that's so far away from my expertise. I think there's probably lots of positive modulators of plasticity. So if I can't answer it that vague way, Does anybody else have a better answer? I'm a motor systems person, I know.
That's great. Talking about in the nature of 2002, spiky pain of plasticity, but after 30 days, they did found in the three-dimensional architecture that axons and dendrites are really changing. You found the same structure within
Is this peri-infarct or in motor cord?
Yeah, in motor cord, it's in rats, also by electrical microscopes.
Okay.
I agree on that the architecture of axons, but there's a lot of...
That was
stroke infarct model?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm not recalling the details of the study, but I do know the study. But I am very concerned that that model that is being used is problematic for it. But Trachtenberg's group outstanding. So I do believe that the results in their model. I don't know. I'm sort of unclear that I want it to be a take home message.
So I have one question myself. It just struck me that your talk has brought us one step closer to the chemistry of the cells. And we're all talking about behavior here. What is the chance that we might mimic the acts of behavior on plasticity with drugs one day?
I think drugs alone will be a challenging way to have the neural activity pattern changes that drive the synaptic changes that change behavior. I think it's very likely that we'll find drugs that facilitate that.
Yeah.
I think it's much easier to use behavior. I know rehabilitative training is hard, but it's the endogenous mechanism for changing the brain. And so unless we want to map out synapses that go with every functional change that we want, but it's the circuits we need, it's probably going to be the way to go.
Mm. Thank you. I think was there one more question? Okay, the last one. Yeah.
Thank you for a nice talk. Just a short question. It takes a lot of timing what you're talking about, and I'm thinking, well, it matters that we get patients into rehab very early so that they do not train unilaterally too long. But have you any idea what is long? Is it a few days? Is it a few weeks? So
I could answer the question in my model, but I don't think it will generalize, which is why I think we need to replace time with some other assay of a brain that's ready to be hit with intervention. I don't know that I don't study big brains. But one reason we're looking at vasculature is the potential, its relationship with the neuronal structural changes is the potential for it to be related to an imaging marker of it. Yeah, so I think that's a very important question. So, yeah, I'm glad you asked.
Well, how long is it in rest?
Oh, how long is it in rest? So, there's not one. So this is one example. If you look at the studies that show time sensitivities, their sensitivities are all different. Now, rehabilitative training continues to work. It's just the potency is not as great. We've trained rats starting at 3 months after, and they benefit greatly from it, just not as well as if you started 2 weeks. Dale Corbett's lab, they examined, I think, something like 5 days, 7 days, something. Correct me if I'm wrong. But anyway, they showed that the earliest was best, a little bit later was intermediate, and the latest was just late. And it's consistent with the idea that interacting with these remodeling events is contributing.
Thank you very much. We are very happy that they went to travel. Thank you so much. Yes, so we could please go.
Okay, so there are a number of possibilities in terms of lifestyle factors that have been studied with respect to both humans and animals. Nutrition, illustrated up here, comprised of fish, it's brain food. Fitness, we'll talk about today. Somebody asked about psychosocial effects. There is a large literature, much of it comes out of Scandinavia, on social interaction and dementia and cognitive maintenance throughout the lifespan. It's mostly epidemiological. It's hard to manipulate social interaction in a randomized controlled trial. And I do not endorse any commercial brain training package, but here's one of the many. And I must pick the right one because I think several of you have worked with Mike Merzick. I'll talk a little bit about commercial brain training as we go through the presentation. I'm very critical of it in many ways. That's not what I'm going to be focusing on today. I wanted to start with a cartoon, and this came out in the New Yorker last year. One gentleman saying to another, "I've been working out for 6 months, and all the gains have been in cognition." Actually, he has a big head. So it is nice to see that the research makes it to the press. I think your rector this morning suggested that we're increasingly scientific illiterate as a society, and I think that could very well be true. But at least some of the magazines portray research humorously, if not accurately. Of course, it's never as simple as what would be suggested in the cartoons and many self-help books that you can buy. Before I forgot, I wanted to thank all of my collaborators and the kind of work I do on nutrition, on cognitive training, and on fitness training really does take a village and people with a number of different skills to support the research. I wanted to start with a poem from a set of neuroscientists. It's a fortunate person whose brain is trained early again and again, who continues to use it to be sure not to lose it, so the brain in old age may not wane. Now, Professor Nudo, when he was up here, was commenting on his gray hair and suggested he might be older than the rest of us. But if that's true, then I would suggest that Professor Nudo is at the top portion of the function gear, regardless of where his age is. And what this illustrative function portrays actually illustrates a lot of data. These are not actual data of cognition, high being good at the top, low being poor across the age span. And for the most part, it's a relentless downward trend, which differs as a function of different cognitive abilities, and ultimately, we all end up at the same spot. But, the benefit of the internet is that Professor Nudo suggested he was the oldest speaker this morning. I went on the internet and found his CV. You're quite a young man. You're 9 days younger than I am. So there you go. I'm claiming I'm the oldest speaker here, Peter, but Professor Nudo was born on April 25th, 1953. I was born on April 16th. So a number of years ago, a number of my colleagues and I wrote this long monograph about the use it or lose it hypothesis that we retitled the cognitive enhancement hypothesis. And looked at the data, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and there certainly is data that supports this hypothesis, but many limitations and boundary conditions. And we'll talk a little bit about some of them today. It's always nice to have pictures, and we've seen a number of pictures and cartoons. The top two photographs are from my late colleague, Bill Greeno, from his lab at the University of Illinois. And I don't know if you can see the rodents, but here's a little rodent head, and here's a little rodent. This is an environment from one of the first complex or enriched environment studies for the last several decades, in which the stimuli, often toys, are changed every 3 days. The initial complex environments had running wheels, and they had a multitude of rodents. So from the set of lifestyle factors that I showed on the first slide, we've got 3 out of 4. The only thing they didn't have was nutrition. You think of it as a multimodal or a sledgehammer intervention, and the question was, does this complex or enriched environment, at least in the lab, simply not compared to the wild, bestow any benefits on cognition and brain structure and function? And indeed it did. And in subsequent years, researchers have pulled apart the different factors of the original studies. This is Bill Cirque de Soleil animal, being trained on various psychomotor skills, to illustrate that social interaction is important, for good or for bad, depending upon where in the hierarchy you might be. And this is what we'll talk about today. This is my beginning slide. I'm not saying this is Oslo. I am saying this is the United States of America. So it's a mess that we have to deal with. Sedentariness and obesity and so forth. I think this must be Texas where our former president George Bush came from. That was at least the little doggy got some exercise. We wouldn't want too much, so we would those escalators, right? But on a more serious note, there are a number of things I'll cover. It looks like a lot, but I'll just hit the highlights. And probably like many of the speakers, I've written review articles. Everything's downloadable for free. It's a PDF on my Illinois site, although I'm now a Northeastern. I still have a lab at the Beckman Institute at the University of Illinois. So since nobody covered this with respect to exercise, there are a multitude, many dozens and dozens of studies over the last couple of decades, and some of our speakers have been involved in this, on the effects of exercise on molecular and cellular function of the brain. And the panels up here are illustrations of slices of the hippocampus, a section of the brain that sits in the middle in the temporal lobes. And all of these little green dots are new neurons being born by virtue of BRDU and NEU stains. These data are from Rusty Gage's lab at UCSC. And what we can see on the right is a graphical illustration of three conditions, a control condition, an enriched condition, like the one that I illustrated from Bill Greeno's lab. And we often don't talk very nicely about the Russians these days in the United States, but it's not the Russians, it's the runners. Russians, runners, and what we see here is that we have a number of new neurons as a function of these three different conditions. In addition to neurogenesis in the hippocampus, or the development of new neurons throughout the lifespan, or at least most of the lifespan, not just the young years, there are a variety of other changes that take place as a function of exercise in mostly rodent models. Mike Merzlik has done some very nice work with dogs, beagles, with a variety of different interventions, including exercise. We have increase in neurotrophins. We've heard about BDNF, the brain-derived neurotrophin, something that's usually derived in animal studies anyway from the tissue you're interested in. But I have to tell my animal researcher colleagues that nobody ever lets me take a little sample of hippocampus, so we tend to look at it in the blood in the human studies. And a variety of other neurotrophins. Synaptogenesis, we've talked about, Professor Jones just talked about this, that synaptogenesis is the increased connections among neurons, increased angiogenesis, the vascular structure, and a variety of other changes that are illustrated in the animal model. So we know a lot about, not everything, but we know a lot about molecular and cellular underpinnings of what I'll tell you about in human randomized controlled trials. One of my favorites, which is interesting, and across the world there have been probably 100 drugs that have undergone clinical trials for Alzheimer's thus far, and it's sad, but they've all failed. In fact, Lilly just reported a failure recently. I was at the meeting where they did that after spending $750 million. It's interesting, however, there are a number of studies with rodents, mostly mice, but also rats, where you can create transgene models and change some of the genes to produce massive amounts of beta amyloid or tau, two of the precursors to plaques and tangles. And when these animals are given running wheels, in many of these studies, these precursor proteins are downregulated and learning and memory improves. So I'm not claiming that exercise can cure Alzheimer's, but at least in the animal models, it has positive effects on some of the precursor proteins and also positive effects on learning and memory. So it's something we can do today as we wait for that wonder drug. Mm-hmm. And, I hope we have one someday, but we certainly don't today. So back to the list here, we talked a little bit about the molecular cellular underpinnings. What about the human work? And there are a number of different human studies. The speakers before mentioned meta-analyses, and I agree completely with Professor Udo, garbage in, garbage out. That's a good motto. This was a meta-analysis that Stan Kopeman and I published in 2003. No garbage, completely carefully selected studies, 18 of them from 1966 to 2001. The first question was, does exercise improve cognition with humans over 58 years of age? Yes, half a standard deviation. Then we asked about moderators of this relationship between exercise and cognition with a big C. And one of the moderators was the nature of cognition, which is listed on the x-axis. Executive control processes, things like scheduling, planning, dealing with ambiguity, multitasking, and working memory all fit under that heading. The role of controllers, automatic distinctions, spatial versus non-spatial, and speeded versus non-speeded. And I think we see two important things in this graph. One of them is that across the board, you get improvements in cognition as a function of exercise in these 18 RCTs from 66 to 2001. Another important point, I think, is that some effects are bigger than others. And if we would have had something called relational memory, which is often thought of as a hippocampal task, and it is, we'd also see a pretty big bar. There weren't many relational memory tasks in human RCTs at the time. So meta-analysis have provided some insights, also some puzzles. I think there are gender differences on some of the slides we've seen today, and in this meta-analysis, another moderator was sex. Women showed bigger benefits than men. It's really interesting to speculate about why that might be the case, and subsequently, Kirk Erickson and I did some follow-up studies where we looked at women purely cross-sectional. Of course, it's always better to do RCTs. But we looked at women who had taken hormone replacement therapy when they were peri- or postmenopausal. And then we looked at whether they exercised or not. And our outcome variables were memory and the volume of the hippocampus. And what we found was a complex interaction, but that is that women who were on hormone replacement therapy for long periods of time had poorer memory and smaller hippocampi unless they were exercising, aerobic exercising. Purely correlational data. These data, there are a lot of them, but the main point is this negative diagonal that's flagged by the red circles. These data are from the largest ever randomized controlled trial of cognitive training ever done. 2,800 subjects, including 800 in the control group that's not represented here. But we see along the top memory training, reasoning training, and speed training. And these are three varieties of training, very specific, but the details aren't important here. They've proven themselves in small studies. Professor Newell also mentioned that small studies tend not to or shouldn't be given much weight to meta-analyses, and I would agree. So this is an attempt to do a big study, a much bigger study, 2,800 older participants. And they were assessed in many factors, in memory, in reasoning, and speed. And the reason the negative diagonal is flagged is because when you trained in memory, you improved in some similar memory tasks, but not reasoning and speed. When you trained in reasoning, you improved in some pretty similar reasoning tasks, but not memory and speed. And the same was true for speed. So for the most part, there are some interesting exceptions. Cognitive training leads to specific benefits. Commercial brain training often suggests general benefits. So there's a mismatch. But fitness, simply walking, leads to pretty broad benefits. Interesting to think about why. We'll talk about that. In terms of other kinds of data that are brought to bear, in addition to the animal models, the meta-analyses, and there are others, epidemiological or prospective observational studies. Really simple, and I'm sure many of you know about them. You measure something now, you wait some period of time, and measure some output variable. And here's one example by Deb Barnes and Christine Yaffrey from San Francisco. What they did was measure how much women walked. This was a study called Women Who Walk. And they had different tertiles, women who walked very little and women who walked a lot more. By the way, a lot more was 1 to 2 miles a day. It's not a whole lot. And the women who walked the most, 6 years later, we see all the significant levels on the right that suggested that they showed maintenance or improvement in a whole variety of different tasks, kind of like the meta-analysis from the RCTs that I showed you. We can also look at meta-analyses, there are a few now, of epidemiological or prospective observational studies. And as a way to get an indication of the magnitude of the benefit, subtract any of these numbers from 1, and that's the percent benefit. So 0.63 would be a 37% benefit. From high levels of physical activity, wasn't that high. These are older folks, and moderate levels were simply walking. Things like walking at a regular pace. So these give you the variables over here give you some indication of the boundary conditions of the moderating variables. But the truth is, these studies were something like 20 studies over 33,000 participants. So these tend to be bigger studies. In fact, the Barnes et al. Study is a small EPI study with about 500 participants. Most of them are much larger than that. But this gives you an indication of the robustness of these correlational epidemiological studies with respect to exercise and cognition. But again, we have to go beyond the correlational studies to randomized controlled trials if we want to establish causal. causality, and there have to be at least two different conditions. One would be what Mr. or Ms. Senefeet suggested, something aerobic. Walking is a good one to start with if you're in your 80s, rather than running or CrossFit. We recently finished a study with CrossFit with 18 to 44-year-olds. That would be a really great way to kill your older participants. CrossFit is pretty nasty, even when you're 20. We had garbage cans close by. If you've done CrossFit, you know what they might have been used for. Also, injuries every so often. So for most of the older adults, it's not CrossFit. It tends to be more aerobic, tends to be walking, sometimes jogging, sometimes bicycling, and sometimes swimming or water aerobics. And then we need some active control condition because we're always worried about expectancy effects or placebo effects. I think in terms of clinical treatment, if you get a placebo effect, great. But in terms of learning about the basic mechanisms, we want to eliminate placebo effects to know if the interventions really have the effects we think they do. So Mr. Gumby didn't do his stretching. Look what happened to him. So these are some of the first, these are the first data I know of, we published a number of years ago now, 10 years, 11 years ago now. It was a simple question with humans. And the question was, does 6 months of, 6 months of exercise, 3 times a week, 45 minutes to 1 hour a day, improve or change brain structure, also brain function, also cognition? I'm just showing you the structure. And we had two groups. We had that aerobic group. They were walkers. They walked more. And most of our studies, it's very easy to get professional couch potatoes in the United States, regardless of age. These are people who don't do much of anything. They park their automobile very close to the shopping mall, so they don't have to walk too much. And most of these folks, when we started them in the study, could walk maybe a quarter of a mile without taking a breather over 60 to 80 years of age. It's not like Europe. So it's much harder to get deconditioned people here, but I'm sure you'll find out. We also had an active control group, toning, stretching, light strengthening, a little bit of yoga, some yoga moves, and a little bit of Tai Chi. This is a double subtraction. After 6 months minus before, walkers minus toners. So any of the blue patches here actually increases in brain volume in the anterior cingulate and middle frontal gyrus in the walkers as compared to the toners across the 6 months. The yellow up at the top here is actually increasing the volume of the anterior commissure and the corpus callosum, the fiber tract that interconnects the two hemispheres. Again, everything in favor of the walkers, not the toners. We can take it further, and here's another study in which we went from 6 months to 1 year, and we picked a number of nuclei, one in which we were most interested in, others that are about the same size. What we were interested in is the hippocampus, because it's one of two places in developed organisms' brains that convincing and robust evidence has been shown for neurogenesis throughout most of the lifespan. I'm not claiming this is neurogenesis. We wouldn't know. But the hippocampus that we see at the top here, the blue line is from the walkers across a year, and the red line is from the toners. And we see this nice and significant separation. To look at this statistically, it was interesting at the time to ask the question of, because we have normative data on brain volume changes as a function of aging. And Professor Gudo and I have shown some, but not tremendous brain changes. Because we're not that old yet, but we're certainly getting there. So what we did was look at, based on the normative data, how far you could push yourself back up with your trajectory, because we have lots of trajectories for a whole variety of labs, including Ullman Lindenberg and Max Planck in Berlin and others. And it was about 2.5 to 3 years, simply by taking up walking, and walking for 3 days a week, 45 minutes to an hour a day. I didn't show you the behavioral data, but within the walking group, there's a nice dose-response relationship between a relational memory task, a spatial memory task, and changes in VO2 max, which is the gold standard for cardiorespiratory fitness and changes in the hippocampal volume. We can also look at fiber tracks, and this is a technique, this is from a technique called diffusion tensor imaging that allows you to look at the integrity of white matter tracks, a measure called FA, fractional anisotropy, which tells you something about the integrity of those tracks. And each of these panels indicates a different fiber track left here on the y-axis as a function of VO2 max, as a function of improvements in cardiorespiratory fitness, and we see a significant relationship in each. So as individuals become more fit in a cardiorespiratory sense, the
integrity of the white matter tracks increases. Ah, a little side note. There's a friend of mine who passed away last year, but she lived in 96. So good long life. So as I mentioned, most of our studies are done with professional couch potatoes. Whether they're children, whether they're patients, whether they're old people, it doesn't matter. You know, we got lots of them. But Olga was nothing like any professional couch potato. In fact, she was nothing like any of us. Nothing at all. She didn't have 26. She had 30 world records when she passed. Olga started track and field, competitive track and field, at 75 years of age. Before that time, she played softball. She was a single mom. She was a teacher in Saskatchewan, Canada. Then she became a friend. And I first got introduced to Olga when Bruce Gleason, a New York Times reporter, asked me if she could come to our lab and we could look at her brain. I was like, this would be interesting, but I'm not sure what I can do with an N of 1. MRI and functional magnetic resonance imaging data tends to be noisy. But what we did was take Olga at 93 years of age, we put her in the magnet, we gave her a whole variety of cognitive tests. In fact, I remember the night before we did the testing, we went out to dinner, and I said to Olga, you know, the students are very enthusiastic. They have a lot of tests, but if you get tired, remember she was 93, just let them know. And she looked at me and she said, Art, I don't get tired. And she didn't. Most of us did. So we put Olga in. She was a track and field athlete, but a sprinter at 93. Her longest race was 400 meters. She did all the field events. I didn't see a picture of one of them as a young man. I was a track and field athlete. In fact, that's how I went to college on a track and field scholarship. We do that kind of thing in the U.S. And I didn't see her doing the event that that I guess I was chosen for. But that was pole vaulting. So I asked Olga, and I figured she started at 75. How could she ever have done pole vaulting? Because you usually blow out your joints pretty early in life. That is, you limp around the way I do now. You have shoulder problems and elbow problems. And she said to me, I had to give that up in my mid 80s. I had to give it up in my late 20s. Nonetheless, let's look at all the different. So, in terms of cardiorespiratory fitness, not great, but remember, she's, I mean, fine for her age, great for her age, but not fantastic, but not unusual. And she wasn't a long distance runner. In terms of exercise, she did apologize because at 93 she was only working out 6 hours a day. How many of us have ever worked out 6 hours a day? Unless you run a marathon slowly. In terms of white matter and hyperintensities, evidence of vascular problems, pretty normal for an 80-year-old. She was a 90-year-old. But what was remarkable, the way we were able to situate her data, an N of 1, in the context of 60 younger women from 60 to 80 years of age. Remember, she was 93. So across a number of functional and structural measures, we could put her in the distribution. And when we put her in the distribution for white matter integrity, especially in the corpus callosum, which is illustrated here, we found out she was off the scale compared to the 60-year-olds. She was 93. And when you think of the nature of the task she was doing, javelin throwing, high jumping, discus, even the hammer throw. Olga wasn't even 100 pounds when she was throwing the hammer. It takes a tremendous amount of coordination between both sides of the body. And I don't know. I wish I could have had Olga as a young child, but I wouldn't have been born for many years. I think my advisor wouldn't have been born for a number of years. But I don't. It's an N of one. It's one period of time. But I think it's still illustrative, perhaps, of what people can do when they're unusual in a way. I had a reviewer, the paper got published, but we had one reviewer say to us, you should have more of her. And I wrote back and I said, and who else has 30 gold medals or 30 world records? There isn't more than her. She's it. So, an aside, but an interesting one. So when we move on from structural to functional data, we can also ask questions about fitness and how it changes the function, not simply the structure of the white matter, the gray matter of the brain. We can often think of it, at least simple, in a simple sense, of this relationship. We know aerobic fitness is related to cognition, but what are the moderators? What are the important variables that can magnify or subtract from this effect? And one of them, we thought, perhaps, is functional connectivity. You hear of it as human connectome, other kinds of things. And this is the way it works in a simple way. It's usually done in a massive analysis. It's usually done in a massively parallel way.
statistics from engineering, but in a simple way, these are actually real data on this slide. These are hemodynamic response functions of functional magnetic resonance imaging data from the left and right motor cortex. We've heard a lot about the motor cortex. This was a synchronous two-handed tapping task in which you're tapping at the same time to a metronome with fingers from both hands. And what we see here, if we're recording the left and right motor cortex, is that the orange and the green trace are pretty much overlapping. The correlation is high. That's what happens. And different areas of the brain tend to work in a coordinated fashion to help us complete tasks. And in the bottom, we had a task that didn't require any coordination between the temporal lobes and the occipital lobes. The correlation is low, and we have kind of a mess. I like the vermicelli ones. Vermicelli. So we can take these data, we're recording functional activity, it's called GOLD, blood oxygen level dependent activity, or fMRI, and we can take this colored book, this looks like a kid's colored book, illustration of a few different brain networks, many of them, certainly above 24 have been mapped out. And these networks have different functions, they're color-coded differently here, like the default mode, or the frontal executive, or the frontal parietal network. And we can ask whether these networks are important and valuable or plastic as a function of improving fitness. You know, people often say to me, isn't it great that fitness maintains cognition for older people? And my answer is no. It doesn't maintain cognition. It improves cognition, at least for a period of time. It's not as simple as you think. So we can take terabytes and terabytes of this voxel-wise data, these three-dimensional pixels, in which we look at functional activity superimposed on the high-res structural data, and we can boil it down to these simple bar graphs. And we do this, and we can look at any one panel. We look at connectivity. This is simply bivariate. It's an easy way to illustrate it. We can look at it as a function of time, 0 months, 6 months, 12 months. And the blue bars are from individuals in the active control group, toning, stretching, and strengthening, and the yellowish-orange bars are from people in the walking group. About 120 participants here, in 60 in each group. And what we find is that the orange bars increase as a function of time or as a function of improving aerobic fitness. They're both true and highly correlated. And that happens for the aerobic but not for the non-aerobic group. So connectivity does increase. Maybe as interesting, the white bar. Those are 20 to 30-year-olds. The other two bars portray 60 to 80-year-olds. So within 1 year's time, many of these connections, certainly not all of them, but many of these connections become statistically equivalent to the 60 to 80-year-olds who become more fit, usually 10 to 15% improvement in VO2 max as 20 to 30-year-olds. That's interesting, but we need to take it a step further, maybe lots of steps. And one of the ways we took it a step further was to look at change in connectivity and change in latent variable measures of cognition. So often, the right way to do it, and we all do it the wrong way before we do it the right way, for most of us, is not have one measure of anything, because one measure of anything has got plenty of error variance. And to the extent that different measures converge, it's like the blind man and the elephant converge from different perspectives on whatever construct you're measuring, you get a better measure. You get a measure with less error variance. So we had at least three measures of executive function and short-term memory, and we looked at delta change in executive function or short-term memory and delta change in connectivity, and there are modest, small to modest correlations, especially in executive function. So not only is connectivity improving, not only is it becoming equivalent in many cases to that of young people, it also is correlated with improvements in cognition. So we can put a little check here, because functional connectivity is important. We can also, the animal researchers in the audience are sitting, so I'm safer here because I've seen them fall off chairs when I presented these data, because I'm looking at BDNF too, but I don't look at BDNF where you look at BDNF. I wish I could. So I look at it in the blood. And what we find here, if we look over on the right, is BDNF change is a function of this 1 year intervention. And we see similar things to what the animal researchers see. Again, not from the tissue that I really like it, simply from blood. We see no relationship between connectivity change and BDNF change for the non-aerobic group and a correlation of 0.57 to the aerobic group. So one of the many things we've tried to do with the research that we've done over the years is to try to bring the human and the animal research closer together whenever we can. And the tools are certainly getting better.
for animal, for human neuroimaging research. They're not where we like them to be, and maybe in the future they will be when we can truly bring the two literatures together. We cannot do that today. How about some individual differences? We've talked about individual differences, and we've even talked about genetic individual differences in previous presentations. So what do we know about genetics here? Well, we're still simple-minded, still single gene. Single genes don't account for a lot of variants, and sometimes they do in single gene diseases, cystic fibrosis, anemia, and others. But even when we learn those single genes, we thought we have a cure, we still don't have any cures. So it's never as simple as you think it is, but there have been some cross-sectional studies where individuals have been genotyped for BDNF or DRD2, DRD4. APOE is probably the most consistent thus far. And it could have worked out either way, but what most researchers have found is that if you're homozygous or heterozygous for E4, which is an allele that predicts early AD with some amount of potency, so being homozygous for E4, about a 15-fold increase in early AD as compared to people that have E2 or E3, those individuals that are at high risk show the biggest benefit on cognition as a function of exercise, which is quite interesting. So consistent with the transgene animal work, there seems to be some human work, both epidemiological as well as some of these cross-sectional studies that suggest an interesting relation between exercise, cognition, and dementia. There are always exceptions and exceptions. There's been an increasing number of studies, and they're difficult to do with mild cognitive impairment in Alzheimer's patients in their exercise RCTs. And many of these studies are very small numbers of patients, but a number of them have suggested positive effects of exercise, even with people diagnosed with MCI in early AD. Here are some of the quibbles we can have with these studies, the same quibbles we have with other underpowered studies, individual differences between men and women, again, fodder for some interesting experiments, subgroups, amnestics, and others, and not all show the benefits. It's a recent study by Laura Baker, who's now at Wake Forest University with 150 participants finding some of the same things, the biggest study ever done. There are a few studies being done. Carl Kottman, Laura Baker, and others are doing studies, a study with hundreds of patients. It'll be really interesting to see what they find. So I'm not picking on MCI because if you're neurotypical, I'm not sure I am, but if you're a neurotypical, that means you don't have any brain disease. There are also positive effects and some negative effects. In fact, the biggest ever randomized controlled trial was the one by Casey Sink and her colleagues, a big trial, didn't find any positive benefits, no negative benefits. I have more than a few quibbles with that one, and I'd be happy to tell you about it, as I put in print recently. But there are potentially a lot of boundary conditions, from genetics to the nature of the interventions to the way we measure cognition and a variety of other things that we need to think about. How about new tools? So on the way to doing this kind of research, we're interested. I work with a number of creative physicists, bioengineers, and others, and chemists. And we've come up with a number of new measures that allow us to quantify aspects of brain function and structure that we weren't able to quantify before. One really simple-minded one is simply not to look at the mean, all the measures that I've shown you thus far and all the measures you've seen on many of the slides are simply mean measures. Standard deviation is interesting. Is it good or bad? Well, it depends. With respect to cognition, if we're talking about a task that becomes highly automated, that is very highly skilled, variability is a bad thing. If we're talking about learning new skills that have many solutions, many means to the end, variability is a really good thing. In an engineering sense, it would be called exploring the state space, looking for the optimal solution and not getting stuck in the local minimum. So we decided to take a look at variability in the hemodynamic response function or Bold signal or fMRI. And what we did first, it's hard to see, but there are little bluish-green patches on all these brain slices. What we mapped out were the areas of the brain with respect to variability in fairly difficult tasks that measured fluid intelligence, adaptive reasoning and problem solving. And we got those, and we used them as masks, and we overlaid them on the brain changes that are found as a function of improvements in fitness. And in a high proportion of cases, the brain regions that relate to fluid intelligence are the activation levels are changed as a function of fitness training. So we now have another measure, this variability of standard deviation, that suggests that variability in tasks that require variability to come up with optimal solutions tend to be a pretty promising correlate of functional brain health as a function of fitness. We've also recently, this is with Neil Cohen and Brad Sutton at the University of Illinois and others, for many years, researchers that study single cells have been studying not just chemical and electrical properties, but mechanical properties of those cells. And we can now do this with the brain in very selective regions. It is a very bizarre looking device. We call it a brain shaker or a head shaker. It goes into the head coil of an MRI machine. And it uses certain frequencies and phases. And you can use those frequencies and phases to look at the plasticity or the mechanical properties of brain tissue within the hippocampus, say, for example. And we were looking at something called hippocampal viscoelasticity, or damp, it's a dampening ratio in the mechanical properties of this piece of tissue. And we found out that this, too, the mechanical properties of the tissue, even better than structural measures, even better than volume measures, accounted for part of the relationship between fitness and, in this case, memory performance. So here's another measure that might be useful. And then finally, with respect to new measures, there's this technique called multivariate distance-based matrix regression, in which you can look at the distance between these complex three-dimensional or four-dimensional, if you take time into account, patterns of brain activity for different functions. And differences among individuals. It makes sense to have a big database. We happen to have a number of big databases. This is a database, 250 young to middle-aged folks who are undergoing an intervention. And let me show you just briefly. I know this is a lot here, but we can map out the nodes that are most sensitive to fitness change, because one of the interventions was fitness. And then we can relate these bluish-colored nodes to nodes in other networks that have been mapped out. So what is the relationship between tissue that's sensitive to cardiorespiratory fitness change and tissue that's sensitive to these other networks that support executive function and visual function and so forth? And here's a simple bar graph to show you what we found. If we go over all the way over to the right, the frontal parietal network, dorsal attentional, and ventral attention networks show the largest correlation with changes in fitness, the nodes that show changes in fitness. So we're able to map the fitness-related networks to other networks that have had different functions ascribed to them. It's the end of the new measures. We have others, but it's frozen like that. We're often also asked about, is there a point of no return? And we've heard some of these questions with respect to previous presentations. What about people with Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, AD, and others? And these are some data, some that I've been involved in, 2 out of 3. This is from Pat Hand at the University of Colorado. She did a meta-analysis of purely behavioral studies and found that cognition showed about the same standard deviation benefit from exercise as we found overall, when we don't look at boundary conditions, in early AD patients. And so again, showing differences, showing improvements from a different baseline, of course. Ergenok, who's the director of the Parkinson's program in the medical school at the University of Iowa, looked at differences in brain patterns and functional magnetic resonance imaging in an inhibition slash attention task. It's like a stroop. It's called an Erickson-Flanker task, and found for those Parkinson's patients that were exercising, bigger changes looked more like people that didn't have Parkinson's disease and better cognition or better selective attention slash inhibition. The chief of the cash has now taken this, these are cross-sectional data, that is now doing randomized controlled trials. She's at Ohio State University. She, when she was in my lab, looked at brain structural differences between MS patients, average age 47, about 60 of them in total, in both in terms of gray matter illustrated, not in gray because the brains are in gray, but yellow, and it's really hard to see these little green patches, but this would be white matter. So MS patients who exercise more, better processing speed, that is, could respond more quickly to perceptual motor kinds of tasks, and better integrity or larger volume of gray matter, better integrity of life. More recently, I wanted to show you this. So again, sitting and searching the internet. So I know there are a number of studies, and I believe you've done some of these, haven't you? Yes. Here's the most recent one I could find. Maybe it's not the most recent one. On individuals who have had stroke and exercise effects. In this case, the finding was that aerobic exercises improved cognitive function, especially for those individuals who had improvements or increases in BDNF, because I assume BDNF is downregulated in stroke as it's downregulated in depression. I don't work in this area, but good news. We've also been working with women who have had tumor resections and radiation and chemo after breast cancer surgery. So the problem there is euphemistically referred to as chemo brain, problems in memory and other aspects of cognition. We looked at both cancer patients who are high fit and low fit. This is hippocampal volume. We find the same thing of the non-cancer patients, so they maintain this difference. This is a relational memory task developed in Neil Cohen's lab. And we find that the women who have had breast cancer, tumor resection, chemo, and radiation, the ones who are higher fit do better for this memory swap error, which is a nice measure of hippocampal function, and that's related to hippocampal volume, which is also related to cardiorespiratory fitness. How about across the lifespan? Because so far I've told you about older folks. We also work with kids, and we work with young adults and middle-aged adults more recently. But with kids, we're interested in some of the same questions. How generalizable across the lifespan are some of these effects? So we started out with this nice little moderator variable effect, in this case looking at hippocampal volume. Two different tasks that the kids were doing in this study, and one was a non-relational memory task, remembering names, or remembering faces, or remembering places, or putting them all together, remembering who you met, where, and what you talked about. That would be relational memory, and that engages the hippocampus to a much greater extent than non-relational memory. And what we found is that the high-fit kids tended to have better relational memory, but no difference in terms of item memory. And that would give you some specificity in terms of the underlying tissue that might be affected in these kinds of paradigms. High-fit kids, and these are kids from 7 to 10 years of age. High-fit kids have bigger hippocampi than the average across the left and the right, and high-fit kids tended to have better relational memory accuracy as a function of hippocampal volume, in fact, all the kids. So what we've seen with older folks, to a great extent, tends to work with kids. Just a little bit more data. We've been interested in learning. A lot of the animal research on exercise uses something called the Morris Water Maze task, which is a learning and memory task. I think of it as a dirty memory, learning and memory task, more like the real world, right? Because you stress these little animals out, and you throw them in a bath of water, they're drowning, and they need to use their memory. Then they're learning to find a platform so they don't sink. We don't like to drown, birds don't like to drown either. So I think of it as a dirty memory task. It's a memory task, right, with anxiety, I'm sure. We didn't throw any little kids in the water, but we did use this. This interesting task that comes out of the cognitive science of educational practice. And it's called study-study versus study-test. So a number of researchers, including Roddy Berger at Washington University and others, have found that if you actually give people these mini-tests, whether they're children, whether they're students in a college or high school classroom, every so often, they tend to do much better than if you just let them study. So the study-study condition is not a very good condition. It's not a very good, of course, it's what we do in education. In fact, my daughter just finished her law degree at a good college in Boston, and I talked to the dean after this because I didn't want to embarrass her when she was there. And I said, so how do you, and I kind of knew what his answer was going to be. I said, so how do you structure the learning and the test? Oh, we have one test at the end of the year, at the end of the semester. What a terrible way to learn. It's not the worst way to learn. So you better be smart to overcome that. And you better be high fit. Because what we found with these kids is that the kids that were higher fit were able to overcome this deficit that can be attributed to a lousy way to learn, just study rather than study test, and use those retrieval instances to improve memory. And no difference there in terms of the more effective strategy. We've also found, we often ask, I think as therapists, many of you want to know, okay, pretty picture, big deal, you know, single units, multiple units, fMRI, how does it work with the patients? So here's one example. We now use standardized achievement tests, math, reading, and spelling for the children, and we relate it to changes in cardiorespiratory fitness. And a number of labs have found it's the inverse. In the United States, we used to talk about jocks, athletes, and dumb. the dumb jock hypothesis. This is the inverse of the dumb. This is the smart jock hypothesis. I'm often asked by people when I go to Ohio State, and I will again, one of the best football, collegiate football teams in the United States, well, if the jocks are so smart, why do the football players have this reputation? Well, that's simple. TBI, right? Traumatic brain injury. Each of them, they weigh 320 pounds and they run fast and you run into another 320 pound guy, you do a lot of damage and you do that repeatedly. So there are dumb jocks. Maybe if they have done brain damage, right? But for 6 years, I was a boxer and a martial artist. And I was a serious one at one time. I'm lucky I can still speak in full sentences. Most of the time. Your resilience genes, too. I'm lucky I have some of those. So these relationships are pretty interesting. Oh, so I wanted to show you. So one of the things we're able to do in Illinois, I was in the Beckman Institute for 27 years. It was a wonderful 27 years. I was the director for the last six. Because anything was possible. It was like a Disneyland for scientists. Anything was possible. And one of the main things we did was build huge, huge virtual reality spaces. And we didn't buy them, we built them. So here's one we built, and I'll show you what we used it for. I was wondering for a while how we can scale up some of these nice little, but much too processed, pure, clean, but simple paradigms in the lab that we were using to look at fitness training or cognitive training or other things. How we could bring the world into the lab with a modicum of control, but still look at various cognitive processes that we thought were important with respect to lifestyle. So I got together with some of my engineering colleagues and we built this thing called a street crossing simulator. And you'll see it. So what we asked kids to do, Division I NCAA athletes, old frail people, we put them in a harness so they didn't hit the floor and have to go to the hospital. We made one mistake, we didn't make it again. Somebody got hurt. And they're on a manual treadmill. As they walk, it generates the input to the math models that generate the graphics that get projected. We have those six-sided cubes, floor, ceiling, all four walls. This is a three-sided cave. And we can put you in an immersive environment. In fact, I thought, I didn't know the older folks would get so scared they'd jump off the back of this, and hence the harness. So you think, is it an immersive environment? It is when you jump off the back because you think you're going to get run over by a car. So see if we can do this here. Anything else? This is a seven-year-old girl. And we asked her across the street, what could be simpler? But we control the flow of traffic, the gap between vehicles, the speed of vehicles. She has stereo goggles on it. This is the simple condition, by the way. Just cross the street. To see, but when you get run over, it turns blood red. We measure everything, how quickly you move, when you move with respect to the vehicles, time to contact from the left and the right. All the time when they cross the street, just like when they drive. They talk on the phone, they listen to music, and they do a variety of other things. Probably eat lunch, read a book. I've seen people I can help you look out the front when you're reading a book with the truth that you can't. But the phone conversations we had the kids do, they were talking to mom and dad on a Bluetooth hands-free phone. The truth is, if you look at the driving literature in the United States, we outlaw handheld phones, but not hands-free. It doesn't make any difference. It's using this, not these, for the most part. So what we look at here is undistracted, and we have the high-fit and the low-fit kids. We're finishing a big RCT with the kids now. And, you know, the high-fit kids do a little better. Crossing success rate is life. The inverse of it is death. So it's a real-world measure. You get killed or not get killed. With music, it's about the same. The high-fit kids tend to do a little better. Look what happens to the low-fit kids, the gray bar. When we asked them to talk to mom or dad on a hands-free cell phone, you know, now you could say, well, the low-fit kids don't move that fast. Well, they measure everything, remember? They do move that fast. In fact, they move exactly as fast. In fact, you know, 70-year-olds move faster than kids because they are really scared. They don't like the environment. What we found is it's actually
poor decision making when they look left and look right. The LoFit kids don't choose gaps between the vehicles they can actually get through. It doesn't have anything to do with the motor output. It has a lot to do with the cognitive output. And, you know, this is like social Darwinianism in action here. LoFit kids die. We've heard a little bit about placebo effects, haven't we? And in cognitive training, there's a big criticism, especially of the commercial cognitive training programs, and they're most certainly susceptible to this. Because many of these, and even some of the research, because many of the experiments with cognitive training will have the beautiful animated, developed by video game companies, the beautiful cognitive training protocol will be compared across the really boring laboratory tests that we design, because we're not video game experts, are we? So one possibility is the benefits you see from these commercial video games are due to placebo or expectancy effects. So we wanted to put that to the test, and this industry has been criticized big time, deserving it. So what we did was to do an online study, SurveyMonkey. There are many platforms you can use. And we put up some of our videos from our fitness training, exactly what people do. And then we had the task from papers we've written, because we're so sure that the public would read our papers. They don't. So we don't have to worry about that. And we asked people in the control condition, toning, stretching, a little bit of Tai Chi, a little bit of yoga, and people in the walking condition, shown the walking condition, which one should have the biggest cognitive benefits. And we have an anti-placebo effect, because what we have are at least equivalents, and in most of the cases, the non-aerobic condition was believed to produce larger benefits in these three tasks that we've used in public, published papers. So at least in terms of placebo effects for fitness training, there aren't any. I know, I'm getting lost. So let me summarize. What we've done, what I've shown so far, relatively brief fitness interventions up to a year, so 3 days a week a year, improves a variety of perceptual, cognitive, and cognitive abilities, increases brain volume in regions which normally show age-related decline for older folks. And interestingly, with kids, you tend to show patterns of brain volume and activation that are more mature than they are. Promising fitness and cognitive and brain effects for kids, and I didn't cover today, but we also look at psychosocial function, depression, self-esteem, self-efficacy. Interesting benefits there, but not exactly the same. Where do we go from here? And this is where I'll stop. This will be the last slide, although I could tell you about some of these things. We need to understand boundary conditions on exercise effects, when they're not all paradigms produce the same effect or even positive effects. I haven't seen any negative effects from exercise, other than a few long joints, so that tends to be extreme exercise. What about combining different interventions? There's a study in Finland called FINGER, which came out recently, and looked at nutrition, exercise, and cognitive training, which had some nice benefits, but didn't pull them apart, so we don't know where they come from. We've done something with a group called IARPA, with young adults, CrossFit, transcranial direct current stimulation, cognitive training, and a little bit of mindfulness training, and some of these combined interventions, and we do have some of our control conditions, we work better than that, unimotor conditions. When, where, how much, is it ever too late? A lot of older folks tell me that, well, it's too late, I've been, I don't exercise. All of our studies have done with our couch potatoes. We got no excuse. We need to exercise. Good for it. No levels. Common and separate mechanisms for some of the different lifestyle factors. Remember the very broad effects from exercise and the very narrow effects from cognitive training. So like there's some interesting differences. Genetic moderators, not much done there, showing a little data. And beyond the laboratory door, whether it's achievement performance, that's another little illustration of Elizabeth Davis' lab, or VR kinds of environments. So that's where we're at today for the young people in the room. If you have an interest in this kind of thing, there's at least a lifetime or two of research to be done. I certainly won't do it all. Thank you. Yeah, she played softball. I don't really think you call it exercise. There's a whole lot of exercise. that nature.
That would be very interesting if you start when you're 5 years old.
Yeah.
You just look at
me for example. Well, Olga could, but Olga's not like the rest of us, unless you have 31 years.
Thank you. So,
I'm going to be critical for lots of reasons. The methodology stinks. There's a lot of inbred studies, that is, companies sponsor their own studies. We can trust a drug company if there wasn't some independent assessment. I guess we do at times. Test their own drugs, and we want to be cautious about that. Often, cognition isn't assessed the way it should at the latent variable level, but with simple measures of various aspects of cognition. And there's potential for huge expectancy effects. Because they have these beautifully designed by often video game companies paradigms, and they're tested against things that a cognitive psychologist, which I am part of the time, would design, which is pretty damn boring and designed for different reasons. And if you want to see the criticism that 70 of us had, 70 neuroscientists, go to Laura Parsons' webpage at Stanford and type longevity something. I don't know. 70 of us wrote a paper, and then the folks that promote the video games, some of the new scientists, wrote a reply. And I was curious, so I looked at who has companies of these. It wasn't flagged. 17 of them have companies that are not flagged. So we call that conflict of interest, I think, in research. So it's not that I'm trying to denigrate research on learning. I mean, I've been doing research on learning for 35 years. I just don't know if we're at the point yet, well, I know we're not, to make broad claims about what cognitive training can do for us in the real world. And there was a lawsuit last year against the rules by the Federal Trade Commission, three attorneys who I helped out a little bit with the literature. It was a lawsuit against the biggest company, the most profitable company in terms of commercialized brain training called Lumosity. The judge assessed a $50 million penalty for false advertising, held back 48 to see if good behavior companies, the new company, so far it has, and fine them $2 million. It's the 50 would have driven them out of business. And it's not that we shouldn't be doing these things or offering these packages. If people enjoy them, go right ahead. Boy, it's a lot better than smoking dope all the time or doing many other things, right? So if you enjoy it, have fun. But don't claim, some of these companies were even claiming out that they cure Alzheimer's. Now, please, that's cruel. And, you know, these things cost a lot of money, and the people that buy them are not people often pay a subscription fee each month to get your data and compare it against normal data, because there's just so many problems. It's not that I don't think we can get there. I think you were asked a question before, what about pharmacological solutions? I believe it's probably going to be a combined solution. Even at the latest Alzheimer's drug trials, which aren't published yet, something I saw in a meeting, they were combinations of drugs, not simple drugs, just as TAC beta amyloid or tau, but combination drugs. Well, combinations of the kinds of things we think were good for us, like nutrition, like having friends, mm-hmm. like being cognitively challenged, getting exercise, sleep, and so forth, they're bound to give you more robust effects because we know all these things have positive effects individually, and we're only starting to look at the interactions among these effects, the synergistic, additive, or multiplicative effects. So do I think cognitive training will be part of the mix? Sure. But I don't think we know enough to make broad and very strong claims about how it'll change your life outside of the lab or outside of the training. So that's my thing. And I'm proud of it.
As a neuropsychologist, and I devoted most of my time on cognitive rehabilitation, I obviously have a couple of questions about swapping out all neuropsychologists with physiotherapists in rehab. I'll do that over a glass of wine at some papas. Thank you for coming.